The pre-K through 12 appropriations subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, please call the roll.
Chair Fawn.
Here.
Vice Chair Bell.
Here.
Representative Lupus.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Bush.
Here.
Federhoff, excused. Haig.
Here.
McClain.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Smith. Trunow.
Here.
Valdez.
Present.
Willite.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
Quorum, sir.
Well, thank you, members. Thank you, Adrian. Members, please make sure all of your electronic devices are turned off or are on vibrate. Members, welcome to the first day of session. We've had an interesting time this morning on all the sort of ceremonial stuff, and now it's time to get down to work. We're going to start that in a meaningful way today. We have a very busy agenda. Just to tell you what we're going to do, we're going to start with HB 3157, which is an appropriations project bill that has one amendment. And as a result, it needs to be pulled off the consent agenda and it will be presented on its own. Then we will take up our proposed committee substitute for House Bill 3, which Representative Tribolzi will present. Then we will do the consent agenda for the 17 other appropriations project bills that are listed on this agenda. And then once we're done with all of our bills, we will have two presentations. The first will be on the categoricals funded in the FEFP, and second will be a presentation on K through 12 virtual instruction. I will again be giving both of these presentations, and to explain why we're going to do them in advance, you know, I've taken the last couple months with the help of my amazing budget team, led by Denise, to really delve into these issues and really understand this silo since I was appointed to this in mid-December. And what I'm trying to do is share what I've learned with you so that I'm not the only one who gathers this information to share. Come on. I don't know what happened. I really like what I had. I had two options. That is what we're going to do. Can you hear me? There are none. Okay. That we're going to get started on our agenda. We're going to first hear House Bill 7, University of South Florida Home Inspection. School Young by Representative Koster. Koster, you are recognized to present the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yours is just on, apparently.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Thank you. House Bill 3157 is a $2.5 million appropriation project request for home inspection for school young students. To be. It is a free parent involvement school readiness program that helps parents prepare their 3 to 5-year-old children for success in both school and home life. It makes parents empower themselves as teachers first by giving them the tools, skills, and confidence they need for children at home. Results from Sarah Hippie research and evaluation studies consistently demonstrate participation in Hippie makes a positive difference in the lives of parents and students. HIPPI curriculum exposes children to early learning literacy skills such as phonological, phonetic awareness, letter recognition, knowledge, and early writing experiences. In addition, the curriculum fosters social, emotional, physical. It's a statewide program serving 20 counties, including Hillsborough and Pinellas. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And member, I think there's something going on with the services. Talk loudly. There is one amendment that's going to be made by me, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Bell.
Thank you, Chair. I authorize to present amendment barcode 002117.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment changes the funding source of this project from the general revenue to the Welfare Transition Trust Fund. This trust fund has previously funded this project. When it was filed, we didn't know if the trust fund had the capacity to fund this in FY21-22. And so now we're amending it to say that if this is funded, it would be funded. That is the amendment.
Are there any questions on the amendment?
Yes.
You recognized?
I just wanted to pass this from the chair, if I can. When you transfer, you're taking money from the trust fund. There's definitely money in that trust fund, and it's not. For this, is it, I just.
You guys can hear me?
No, there's definitely something going on. The sound system.
So with the transfer of funds, these funds already exist in the trust fund, or the
yes, you are recognized, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was, are there funds available in this trust fund for this? The answer is yes. We have made the amendment. This will free up January 11th to be able to be spent on other things. So, when I'm given a budget to member projects, this is a project that will not have to be funded out of that budget in this trust fund as it has in previous years.
No, just thank you.
You're recognized, Barbara.
Thank you. I just want to understand.
Representative Wilhelt, you recognized?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Fund, I think the other half of that question is, if you're taking this $2.5 million out of that trust fund, is something else that needs to be cut because you need to put $2.5 million out of that trust fund?
Recognized, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. No, this is allocated for that purpose.
Any other questions, comments? Rep. Williams, you're recognized?
There is a bill itself.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Any other thing on the amendment? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the amendment in the audience? None. Is there any objections to the amendment? Seeing none. Amendments, show amendment 002117 adopted, and I will turn the gavel back to Chair Fine.
No, without objection, it will be shown as adopted. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome, and hopefully the first of many times that you'll be in your legislative career. All right, so we are back on the bill as amended. Representative, come on back up. Are there any questions on the bill? Yes, Representative Williams, you're recognized for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just give me the area that this is actually covering?
It covers 20 different counties throughout Florida. I do not have a specific list of every county that's covered. I can get that to Chair Fine to share with the entire committee. And I don't have the list of every county, but it is covers 20. And I know that it covers both counties in my district, which are Hillsborough and Pinellas.
Absolutely. We will get it, and then we will distribute it to the members of the committee.
Absolutely.
Seeing none, we have the public testimony. We have one electronics appearance card, Cron Leandranco from Florida PTA. Do not see them here, but they are they're a proponent of the bill. Come back. You're not done yet. Is there any debate?
Say that this is a great bill. I've seen this program work and it's going to change families and change lives. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Absolutely.
Yes. Has a close on your bill.
I'll waive close, Chair.
Adrian, please call the roll.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Lupus?
Yes.
Roman?
Yes.
Yes.
Brooks?
Yes.
Models? Light?
Yes. Thank you, members. By Friedman 57 as amended will be reported.
Thank you, Chair.
All right, we are now going to move on to our first until policy bill, and only one for today, is the proposed committee substitute for HB 3, the home book delivery for elementary students, being presented today by Representative Tribulsi. Representative Tribulsi, you are recognized to present the PCS.
Thank you, Chair Fine, and good afternoon, members. A child's ability to read is critical to his or her success, not only in school, but in life. Assessments from 2018-19 school year showed that 43% of Florida's third grade students were reading below grade level. This is an alarming statistic because 88% of high school students who do not graduate struggle with reading in third grade. The PCS creates the New Worlds Reading Initiative, which delivers hard copy books monthly to elementary school students who struggle with reading and provides resources for their parents to help improve reading performance. The PCS requires the Department of Education or a statewide third-party organization to administer the initiative. The administrator is responsible for curating books to be distributed, coordinating book delivery, and providing digital tools to parents. Under the initiative, school districts are responsible for identifying eligible students, which are those who have a substantial reading deficiency or who are reading below grade level based on state assessments. The student will remain eligible for the initiative until they are promoted to sixth grade or their parent opts out. The PCS requires that books be provided at no cost to families. That is the PCS for HB 3.
Thank you. Are there any questions on the PCS? Yes, Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Chair Fine, and thank you for bringing forward this great bill.
By the way, just the microphone issue is endemic. It's not you, it's going in and out. So just do everybody talk loud.
My mask. My question is, participating in this program.
You're recognized?
Thank you for that question. Absolutely, charter schools are included in this program.
Is there any other questions? Oh, yep, you gotta raise your hand big. Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Fine. Hi, I just have a question. How many children are impacted statewide and what is the cost?
You're recognized?
So at this time, we don't know what the cost will be because we still need to go through the procurement process. Okay. However, at this time, based on 2018-19 studies from children and reports, we are estimating about 5,700,000 students kindergarten through grade 5.
Just to ask follow up on that, that's eligible. That's not necessarily who, because not everyone may choose to participate. That's the university eligible.
Correct.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes. Question.
Okay.
Thank you, Chief. So many districts have similar programs. So you can tell. Can you just tell me why this is for the whole state?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Many school districts have similar kind of programs. Can you tell me why this is different and why we need this in the whole state?
Recognized.
Thank you for that question. So yes, they do. So I believe in speaking in phone with you, your Children's Services Council offers one book per year to children that are qualified in your area. This is much different because this will be offering to eligible children and families who opt in one book every month for 9 months throughout the year.
Thank you, Chair.
Good. Any other questions? Seeing no additional questions, we do have three electronic appearance cards. Catherine Bohemi, from the Foundation for Florida's Future, waves in support. Debbie Morthrum for the Foundation for Florida's Future, waves in support. And Philip Cederman from Americans for Prosperity, waves in support. Is there any debate on this bill? Yes, Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for this anything that we can do to help our children read more is a benefit. My own, and our church has the same thing. The concern is obviously the appropriation of this. You're considerably increasing the number from 1 to 9 books. I'm anxious to move the funding from this and what it's going to be. One of the other things that I just need to hear and obviously helping our children. Thank you.
These mics are off.
All right, members, I think everyone's getting frustrated, so we are going to take a short recess and see if we can get the, we've been told if we take a couple minutes, get the microphone fixed. So we're just going to stay here in short recess. Sorry, you're going to have to stay here today a little bit longer than you wanted, but we will get to try to get the microphone fixed. So with that, we stand in recess. All right, thank you, members. After that brief IT assist, hopefully our microphones are going to work now, so we will continue. Is there any additional debate on Representative Tbilisi's proposed committee substitute to 18.3? Any other debate? Okay, seeing none, I just would make a comment. 11 years ago, my almost 13-year-old son learned about a program similar to this. It's called TJ Library. It's a program offered to Jewish children all over the country. It doesn't cost anything. It's not government funded, but we signed him up for it when he was 2, and he has gotten one book, Jewish-related book, Jewish content, Jewish children's book, Jewish chapter book, every month since he was 2 years old. In 11 years, he has gotten more than 130 of these books. Now, it costs about $40 a year, for those who are curious to how much. It's free, but I send them a check for $80 every year because I have 2 kids and I'm happy to do that. But it's $40 a year, so and millions of Jewish children around the world now participate in this program. Now, I don't know if they would have been bad readers without this program, but what I will tell you is this. If our house were ever to catch on fire, and after I knew that everyone was safe and our pets were safe, the first thing I would grab of possessions would be my son's national park binders for all the national parks that they've been to. But the second thing that I would grab, and the second most valuable thing that my wife and I believe that we have in our home, is these now more than 200 books that we have gotten to create an amazing library of Jewish children's books. So I'm very blessed that I've had this, and I think it's a program that, frankly, every Floridian should be blessed to do. So we're very lucky that you're bringing this bill forward so that those people who may not have the $40 a year to provide those books to their kids can get them as well. And so I'm glad you're bringing it forward, and I hope that every member will support your bill. And with that, you're recognized to close.
Oh, I am on. Thank you, Chair Fine, and I appreciate that. You could actually come up and close for me. That was brilliant. Thank you for sharing. Books have always been an important part of my life, and that was by in part my parents' gift to me as a child. A lot of times, books were my best friends. My oldest sibling was 6 years older than I was, and my parents were super overprotective. So books were my friend, and they still are. You can ask my husband. There's probably a book in every room in my house that I'm reading at some time. I'm certain that I wouldn't be today here in Florida's legislature without the ability to read or the books that I've read along the way, and I continue to read. But for children, when I was a child, again, books were delivered to my house. Highlights magazine was delivered to my house. We had so much fun. I was so excited to go out every month and get a book or a magazine that was delivered to me. I had every Nancy Drew book and lots of nights reading Encyclopedia Britannica. I truly believe that the journey of a lifetime begins by turning a page, and I believe that we owe it to the children of Florida to support HB3. And with that, I close.
Adrian, please call the roll on PCS for HB3.
Chair Fahn?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bill?
Yes.
Representative Alufis?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Bartleman?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Federhoff? Haig?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Roach?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Trunow?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Wilhite?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
14 yeas, the bill passes, sir.
All right, members, by your vote, the PCS for HB3 will be reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. We will now take up the consent agenda and vote once on the agenda in its entirety. The public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up question, debate, and vote on each of the bills individually. Instead, we will be in questions and debate only once. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a nay vote consent agenda form with the administrative assistant before the vote. Members, in your packet, there is a list of the appropriation project bills. There are 17 of them. With that said, are there any questions? Okay, seeing none. Public testimony. I have the following electronic appearance cards. Britta Lincoln with Florida PTA is a proponent of HB 3217, 3625, 3829, and 3479. Con Leanne Banco from the Florida PTA is a proponent of 3829. And Matt Spritz of Kids Safe Foundation and Boca West Community Charitable Foundation is a proponent of 3191. Members, is there debate? Seeing none, before I call the vote on the consent agenda, Adrian, are there any nay vote forms? Okay, there are not. So, Adrian, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda.
Chair Fine?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bell?
Yes.
Representative Alupis?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Bertelman?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Federhoff? Haig?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Roach?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Trunow?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Willite?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
14 yeas, the bill passes, sir.
All right, members, by your vote, all of the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Okay, so now we've sort of finished the business portion of this. We're gonna move on to the two presentations that we have for today as we kind of keep working on that budget and getting it ready to present over the next several weeks. We're gonna do two presentations today. The first is going to be on the FEFP, or the Florida Education Finance Program categoricals. We've talked in previous presentations about what we spend and how much we spend. Today, we're gonna talk about dig a little bit deeper into a component of the spending. So I've got the thing here, and I'll take questions on this presentation at the end, and then we'll move on to the second one. All right, so the Florida Education Finance Program, or FEFP, this chart we have seen before. There are two major components of the FEFP. There's base FEFP, and that's the allocation that's basically based on your quantity of students times their factor. But that's $13.8 billion. And when people focus on education funding, unfortunately, all too often, this is the number that they only focus on. And they say, oh, base funding only went up X or Y or Z. But the fact of the matter is over a third of the funding that we spend on K through 12 education is provided through categoricals. And we do these to make sure there's equal access to educational services or to fund specific statutory policies. But last year, that was $7.1 billion. So there's basically complete flexibility at the local level on that base FEFP funding. The categorical funding, as we're going to discuss, goes into various areas. And I wanted to do this presentation because I think that one-third of the amount of money that we spend generally doesn't get included when people are talking about how much money we spend on education. In fact, if you include it and you're only looking at the base funding, you'd be increasing that number by 50%. So here are the categoricals. There are 21 of them established in statute. 19 of them were funded in last year's budget. I'll talk about why two of them weren't funded in a little bit, but declining enrollment allocation and the discretionary lottery and school recognition categorical were not funded. All but three of these categoricals are funded with both state and local funds. There are three that are funded state only: the state-funded discretionary contribution, class size reduction, and the discretionary lottery school recognition program, which was not funded last year. And if you look off to the right side of the slide, you can see them. Some of them are quite big. The ESE guaranteed allocation is more than $1 billion. Class size reduction allocation, over $3 billion. And then obviously some of them, you can see virtual, we'll talk about it in a minute, are quite small. But these are actual numbers that we are placing in the budget for these 21 categories. In your packets, Under the tab entitled Summary of Florida Education Finance Program Categoricals, there's a more detailed document that provides a description of each categorical, when it was established in the FEFP, and which school districts are currently receiving the categorical. It's a nice summary spreadsheet. We're not going to go through it here today, but again, as you choose to get more educated on the K-12 budget, it is available for you to take a look at. All right, the FEFP categoricals. So school districts generally want to advocate that any increase they get is base FEFP funding. Why? Because they have total discretion on how to spend it. When we can put, we put in strings attached when we fund things through categoricals. So for certain categoricals, school districts are required to spend those funds on only the services or items that are in statute. So for example, when we put money in the reading instruction allocation categorical, you can't spend it on math education. It has to be spent on reading instruction or student transportation or instructional materials. These are decisions that the legislature, for whatever reason, in its infinite wisdom, have decided we want to make sure that a certain amount of money is spent on these certain priorities. And obviously, if you're a local politician, you would like to have more flexibility and not less. So that's why we often see so much of the focus on base student allocation as opposed to categoricals. Categoricals are where we get to make sure stuff gets spent on what we want it to be spent on. State and local funded FEFP categoricals. Here's one of the big ones. ESE, which is basically special needs and gifted students, but not all. So it's the second largest funded categorical. It's $1.1 billion. It provides services for ESE students with IEPs that are at this level of service for low or moderate. If you've got severe needs, you're funded through the base student allocation by giving a much higher cost factor. And it also funds K through 8 gifted education. Virtual is the lowest funded categorical. That's not missing zeros, it really is $6,000. And it was funded to ensure the Florida Virtual School receives an amount per FTE as specified in the GAA. We haven't really had to use it because of how the GAA has worked. The implementing bill, so we will also, when we do the budget, we will pass an implementing bill. And the implementing bill last year suspended the funding for the declining enrollment allocation for FY 2021. This is an old categorical, it's 41 years old. And the reason we are not using it anymore is because we used to not have a process for knowing how many students were attending. And so what happened is sometimes if your school district went down, it caught everyone by surprise. And so this money was there to help address that. But since then, we have this formalized estimating conference process for not only predicting how many students will come, but then we do this count every year. And school districts participate in the funding estimates. So they have this access to this forecasting data 5 years out. So they have the ability to plan. And this is, again, something that was needed 41 years ago. It's not so much needed today. We haven't done it in the past, and the governor's recommended budget continues suspending it in the future. The implementing bill from last year also creates funding compression and hold harmless allocation. This has always been in the implementing bill. It was created as the funding compression allocation in the prior 2 years, and it was amended to add hold harmless and reenacted in last year's. And to qualify for this, you have to have prior total year funds per student that are less than the prior year statewide average, or you have to have a current year district cost differential that's less than your prior year DCD. And again, lots more information if you want to learn this. Other categoricals, this is the biggest one, the class size reduction allocation. This was created through an amendment to the Constitution. It was established to assist school districts to maintain the class size requirements in that constitutional amendment. This is funded solely, that $3 billion is 100% state funding, no local funds. School districts were required to be in compliance at the class level by FY 2010-2011. The categoricals adjusted based on the workload, but current statute authorizes charter schools and control open enrollment schools to be compliant at the school level, not at the class level. These schools account for almost 97% of all public schools, and funding this discretionary amount is hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The difference between funding it at the school level and funding it at the class level, that's $3 billion. For those of you who've been around for a couple of sessions, these categoricals will be familiar to you. In 2018, we had the tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. As a result, we passed some landmark legislation to try to deal with some of those issues, and two of the categoricals were affected by that. The Safe Schools allocation has been around for a while, but we dramatically changed it after Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. We use it to assist school districts in their acquisition of safe school officers, and we increased the funding by almost $100 million. Again, the legislature wanted to make sure that money was spent on that purpose. That's why we put it as a categorical. Mental health assistance allocation was also something that we did. We created it as part of that bill to assist school districts in establishing and expanding mental health care. $69 million was appropriated after that, and then it is increased to $100 million. And by the way, again, school districts can spend more than this if they want from all of their money. This just requires that these funds be spent on these purposes. One that we created last session was the teacher salary increase categorical. The governor talked about that this morning, moving Florida from among the worst paying, starting pay states to one of the best. We added this in 2021. We appropriated $500 million with $400 million prioritized to increase full-time classroom teachers' minimum base salary to $47,500 or the maximum amount achievable within the district's allocation. This has not been fully implemented yet. 63 districts have approved plans. Three are being reviewed by the DOE. They have to be reviewed and signed off on to make sure they're actually using it in line with how we intended it be spent. That's Alachua, Escambia, and Sarasota. Five districts are still negotiating with their union, I presume: Bradford, Indian River, Lee, Nassau, and Santa Rosa. Obviously, those negotiations are not going very quickly, given how long this bill has been in place. And then three districts are at impasse with their local union: the FAMU Lab School, Martin, and Polk County. All right, last takeaways before I answer questions. And again, there's lots more you can learn as we focus on categoricals. But these are the three things I hope that people take away from this presentation. First, focusing only on the base student allocation is misleading, because it doesn't account for what we spend on K through 12 education, and it particularly doesn't account for new ones or existing ones. Again, $500 million was put in to pay teachers more last year. If all you do is look at base funding, there's no credit given for that. So people have to take a holistic view of how education, and I won't spend a lot of time in this committee ever focused on base student funding per student, because it's misleading and it is inaccurate. But that said, as you saw, some of these categoricals have been around forever. And as I did in higher ed the last 2 years, we try to take a look at everything over the 2 years and say, well, just because you've been doing something for 40 years, does it make sense to continue to be doing it today? So we're going to review categoricals to ensure that they are still ensuring that equal access that we want, or are addressing the intended policy initiative. Because again, the more categoricals we have, the more complicated the education budget is. In an ideal world, if we just gave every school district X amount per student, it'd be very easy to understand it. Every categorical has the cost of complexity in understanding our education financing system. And then again, that's my sort of final point here. I would, wherever possible, we should eliminate complexity, because it makes it easier for us to understand it. It makes it easier for our constituents to understand it. Complexity is usually inherently bad. Simplicity is an inherent good. So any questions on categoricals? Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized for a question.
So, I spoke to staff about this at length, actually, and we were on the phone an hour, I think, when I first got elected, because the concern I have, it has to do with the DCD categorical and how my county in particular is negatively impacted. And one of the problems is, and I guess staff can speak more eloquently to this, is there's no way to replicate the formula that was originally devised. And then they tried to fix it a little bit, but at what point in the process am I able to try to address the DCD? And I don't think it's not a statute issue, it's like a formula issue with how it's implemented.
So, fair question, although not a subject of this. The DCD is used to calculate the base student allocation. And for those of you who remember, we talked about that in the past, we bucket students into one of seven buckets. And I don't remember what they are, but depending on where you are, your number is multiplied by some amount. It's multiplied by one. In the case of highly special needs students, it's multiplied by a much larger number. That is not factored into categoricals. That is a function of last year. The House did attempt to make some efforts to reform the DCD. It was not successful. The Senate did not agree with the House's view on changing the DCD. But no matter how we change the DCD, it would not affect these categoricals because it's not part of the categorical calculation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Fine. And I appreciate so much this presentation. And when we talked about the class size categorical, considering the COVID situation, and now moving forward, when all students get back to going to school, I can't wait for that to happen. Considering the spaces that one needs to have in consideration, and being that this class size is a constitutional amendment, I wonder how many school districts in the past have not complied with class size and has had to pay a penalty for that. And moving forward, and this might be a conversation for later on, what are our thoughts on class size, considering that it's a constitutional amendment, right? It's something that we must do. And also affording the supports that these school districts will need, considering this spaces that you need to take, how many square feet is in a classroom. I don't know. I think that that's going to be quite challenging and something I don't know if we've really thought about, to think about what we can do to help districts and if we need to do something legislatively as well to accommodate for that. I don't know what the thoughts are.
So most comply. It's a very small non-compliance. The purpose of this categorical is to meet the constitutional requirement. If for whatever reason the legislature wanted to do something else to help them make their class sizes even smaller than those constitutionally mandated limits, we certainly could do that. That would be a policy decision. I would note, though, as we talked about last week, we have $2.8 billion flowing down from being borrowed from those exact same students that can be used for COVID-related needs. This would certainly, that your idea there would certainly be something that the school districts could spend that $2.8 billion on. And I believe since we last met 2 weeks ago, the Congress has continued to move another $1.9 trillion in borrowed money, of which $170 billion would be to help reopen schools, which I find ironic given our schools are open. But if that bill were to pass, there will be an order of magnitude more than we have already been given in borrowed money for that. And again, school districts could use that money to have fewer students in a school if they so chose. But if we wanted to create a COVID class size categorical, again, that's the prerogative of the legislature as we create our budget every year.
And thank you for bringing
your follow up.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing up the CARES Act dollars. And we must recognize that the Department of Education has yet to issue the second CARES Act dollars to the school districts. So although Congress is moving with their third one, if our Department of Education is not dispersing those dollars, CARES Act 3 or whatever we want to call it is not a moot point. So until those dollars come in, school districts at this point don't have anything to plan with, right? So that's why the question, when we talked about class size and as a categorical, and understanding that we, the voters, made that decision
to put into our Constitution and must honor that. And by the same token, considering, I just don't want our schools to look like portable cities again.
Sure. So your question about the $2.8 billion, I actually think that the department is recognizing the spending authority of the legislature. Obviously, CARES 1 was issued when we weren't here, and so they certainly, but we're here now, and I think they're sort of waiting on some direction from us on that, as opposed to sort of the executive branch continuing to appropriate, which is the right way to do it. But again, my point is that the federal government has borrowed another $2.8 billion. If you refer back, $2.8 billion, we're spending $21 billion, so literally more than almost 15% of our budget has been borrowed money to go to some degree in addition to this, and that would be. So there is federal money coming to deal with COVID, and again, it looks like that $2.8 billion won't be the end of it. So, but, you know, again, the class reduction one is to meet the constitutional requirement, not to say, hey, I only want to have 8 kids in a classroom because of COVID. Yep, sure.
Thank you, and yes, absolutely. Again, class sizes is a constitutional amendment. It's something that we, the voters, voted on and that we wanted. And it's not about reducing it. It's just that times have changed now with this COVID situation. And we need to think outside the box when it comes to class size and meeting that constitutional amendment. By the same token, I must caution us that although, yes, the federal government is issuing these relief dollars, they are one-time dollars that we should not be considering for recurring expenses. That is extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that.
Agreed. But hopefully COVID's not a recurring issue as well. So, all right. Any other questions on this presentation? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to change topics. Is it going to be the next one? Okay. We're going to change topics, and we are going to talk about virtual education, something that's become much more popular, surprisingly, in the world that we live in of COVID. All right. So Florida actually leads the nation in virtual instruction. We have the Florida Virtual School. It is funded as a special school district in the FEFP, sort of like a state-level school district. But it is not the only option that is available to parents and students should they wish to attend virtually. In addition to the statewide FLVS option, the current law requires every school district to offer at least one option in addition to the fact that their students can sign up at FLVS. The first thing they can do is they can contract FLVS and do an FLVS franchise agreement where they basically change the Florida Virtual School and they make it, you know, whatever county virtual school. They can contract with another virtual instruction provider, so other than FLVS, to provide virtual education options to their students. They can actually do a deal with a different school district and say, you know what, in Broward County, we don't want to do it, so we're going to cut a deal with Dade County, and our students will go through their virtual program. And by the way, I just made that up. They're not doing that, but to give you an example. They can create it themselves. They can say, we are going to reinvent the wheel, and we're going to create our own district-developed virtual instruction program, which is completely different from FLVS or an outside provider. They can execute an agreement with a virtual charter school. There are 5 of these that exist in the state of Florida. And they can contract with an approved virtual course provider. What's the difference between a virtual instruction provider and a virtual course provider? A virtual course provider might only provide like some of the classes that you need, where a virtual instruction provider would provide all of the classes that you need. School districts can do more than one. They're not limited. They can have a virtual charter school and do an agreement with FLVS. They can do multiple of these, but they have to do at least one, and they can do different options for each grade grouping. But there still are teaching requirements to be a teacher in all of these. You have to have a Florida teaching certificate. The curriculum must still be aligned with our state standards. We fund differently for virtual. In virtual, we fund based on completion. So it's a performance-based metric, as opposed to brick-and-mortar schools where we fund based on attendance. In virtual, you no finishy, no money, which is good. My son is right now taking two virtual requirements, the virtual classes through Florida Virtual School, and so I understand why they do it this way, because you need to have the incentive to make sure the students finish. Virtual FTE students are identified in our student forecast. We do adjust the FTE by looking at the total number of virtual courses and applying a factor that uses historical data to estimate how many will actually finish. We do fund virtual all along the way, but in the June FTE survey results, we true up if our completion rate is higher or lower than was predicted. That is a big difference with virtual. Okay, so what are your enrollment options? There are seven. Again, the one that's not on here is you can go to FLVS. But in addition, within your district, you can, if they've done the franchise agreement or contract, all of the options that I've talked about. And by the way, statewide, between virtual instruction providers, virtual charter schools, and virtual course providers, there are 20 organizations that are providing these services in addition to Florida Virtual School and school districts creating it on their own. But you can also go out of district. So a student in Brevard County could, in five of these instances, attend virtual school in a different county or Florida Virtual School. What are some observations? We're going to talk about counts here, but FLVS enrolls the majority of our virtual students. In last year, we're going to look at, you know, the pre-COVID number. Two-thirds of students that were enrolled virtually were enrolled in FLVS, about 40,000 of 60,000. And if we look at growth over a five-year period or four-year period from 15, 16, and 19, 20, the virtual charter school option had the highest percentage of growth. So these are, again, I'd mentioned there are five of these. These are charter schools. They just operate virtually. They went from about 950 students to 3,600 students over that period, a 284% growth. And the FLVS and FLVS franchise options, which is when a school district basically just buys the software from FLVS, it grew the slowest on a percentage basis, but not in numbers, 32 to 39 in FLVS and 8 to 10 in the franchise agreements. Now, COVID sort of changed the game as a result of this, because look, you know, some people, for good reason, said, I don't want to send my kids to school, and we already have robust virtual options, so they chose to take advantage of it. So we more than doubled virtual enrollment from 60,000 to 131,000 students. Just so you understand, when we talk about the 87,000 missing students, that increase is not in there. So those students that went to virtual are not considered missing. We knew where they were. So that's 87,000 who aren't going to one of these virtual school options, more than doubled. District-developed virtual instruction program exploded. A lot of districts said, hey, we need to make our own virtual school, and so it exploded to almost 19,000 students, a 600% increase. Virtual charter schools increased as well to 1,542 students. And this next slide shows where we were. So FLVS was at 32,000 5 years ago, 39,000 last year, a 22% increase, and then 53,000 this year. Franchises went from 8 to 10 and then exploded to 38,000 due to COVID. Virtual charters went from about 950 to 3,600 and then exploded to 5,000. District-developed virtual programs went from about 1,000 to almost 3,000, then boom, exploded to 21,000. The FLVS provider contract, 950 to 2,000. Again, boom, 8,400 students. And then getting virtual courses from a provider went from 1,500 to 2,000 and then went up to 4,500. One of the things that we need to keep in mind in all of this is many of these students who are now attending virtual school like it. They say, this is pretty good. There's no reason to assume that these students will necessarily go back to a bricks and mortar school. They may find that this is a program that works much better for them. Some more observations. One thing that we've seen, and you're gonna see some troubling statistics on this in a minute, is the number of students enrolling in a virtual program outside of their home district is really beginning to increase. And this does not include people going to Florida Virtual School. You can see from 18-19 and 19-20, in-district went up 6%, out-of-district went up 120%. So more students are choosing to go to virtual schools outside of their district, and this is going to show why. And I think this is something that we're gonna be looking at here in this committee. Three school districts have more than 20% of their virtual FTE residing out-of-district. So Duval County has 1,500 kids from the district in their virtual school, 400 from outside the district. Osceola has 860, but just as many basically are from outside the district. And then the really weird one here, Hendry County, which is a pretty small county, has 63 students in their district that are attending their virtual school, and they have 5,684 students who do not live in Hendry County attending their virtual option. 99% of their students are not from their county. In Duval and Osceola, this is happening because they have a virtual charter school, Florida Cyber Charter Academy, that clearly people who live in other counties would like to send their kid to Florida Cyber Charter Academy for whatever reason, and these are their options, Duval and Osceola. In Hendry, Hendry created a contract with an approved virtual instructor in 2019-2020, establishing what they're calling the Digital Academy of Florida. And as you can see, it exploded. 19-20 went from 11 or 9 kids to 1,200 and then up to 5,700 this year due to COVID. And again, these are all kids who are attending from out of county. All right, so key takeaways. Lots of choices, maybe too many choices. Why? Again, complexity is not inherently good. There are many choices for students to enroll in virtual instruction in their district and outside of their district, let alone FLVS. Hendry and Osceola, more than 50% of their students are not from their own county. School districts reporting the FTE are funded for the FTE regardless of the student's residency. So when one district poaches another district's student, that shows up in our funding issues. And then obviously the giant takeaway here is COVID has more than doubled the number of students enrolling in virtual instruction, and there's nothing that says that they don't stay that way in the future. So any questions as it relates to virtual instruction? Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair Fine. As it pertains to accountability, do all of the schools you mentioned, are they responsible for FSA, EOCs, and complying with all of statement? I think they are, but I just wanted to verify, especially the academies you mentioned.
Yes, to my son's great frustration. As he must take the geometry EOC for Florida Virtual School.
And then my second question is, if I can have a follow-up,
yep,
please,
you're
sir.
Recognized.
So because they're virtual programs, when they take the FSA, are they mandated to come in to take those tests, or are they taking them online?
I believe they are taking them in person. There are some challenges. One might imagine in taking a civics class, online. I'm sure my son might really like that. Oh, I don't know the answer. But I mean, there are, it is much more difficult to catch issues in an online setting than it is an in-person. I believe they're required to show up in person.
Can I ask?
Yeah, you're welcome. Recognize again.
Thank you, Chair. So with the FSA, how are they, who is administering the FSA to the FLVS students and the students around the state? Do they go into the the district to take it in their school? This is just a very important question with everything going on now.
Sure, we can look into that some more. My understanding is for my son, he will be taking the geometry EOC at Brevard. He's taking the class from FLVS. He'll be taking the EOC in Brevard. Brevard Public Schools offers a geometry EOC date. He'll show up and he will take it.
All right, I appreciate that information. Thank you.
Any other questions as it relates to virtual education? Yes, Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that brings me to a question the other day that I had. Obviously, there was discussion from the Department of Education about all students would have to come in to take standardized bricks and mortar testing. And so, obviously, what you just answered, let alone coming to what the answer really is, if parents don't choose to bring their kids into those bricks and mortars, and what will the ramifications be if they choose not to? Obviously, third grade and 10th grade are the most compelling ones because they have to pass those. So that's a question I asked for the Department of Education. I'm awaiting a response. But to my other questions or comments, I'm very concerned, as you talked about, and you mentioned in your presentation the out-of-district students. It's no disrespect to any school district, but what is the root of why those parents are not participating in their own home district? Do we need to look at those districts to find out if they're not offering things, if there's problems within their virtual aspect of it, those different things, to find out why parents would go, especially to some of those alarming numbers in one of those counties, to another area? Now, I'm glad to see that the funding follows the student. I think you answered right, reporting it correctly. The funding follows where the student is reporting?
Yes.
Okay, and so I think we should look at that as a concern to look at. But you know, something that I find a little troublesome is even the comments today made it in the chamber about students having a education gap or lapse or lack of in social interaction, whatever all those things are. If parents are choosing to do virtual school, I think we should be giving the deference to the parent who's choosing to do that with their child versus what we feel is best for that child. Because as we can see in your numbers here, not to mention Florida Virtual School has always been a great school and done great things, parents are making that choice. Now, again, I think I've expressed to you my concerns and my specific example of my son specifically is doing so much better in virtual school and from home. So I think this, for someone to insinuate that all students would do better in bricks and mortar is just infactual, not factual. Like I say, as a parent, as a taxpayer, whatever that I'm making that decision as the parent of that child to do what I think is best for them. And when it works for them, I think we just have to understand that some parents obviously believe this is the best system for their kids. And so us saying that every bricks and mortar student has to go, everyone has to go back in bricks and mortar, I think is disingenuous because we offer different kinds of educational lessons, whether it's charter school, virtual school, all those different ones. So I just think that this proves to us and these numbers show. Now, again, those numbers may be skewed by COVID to some extent, but I learned from COVID that it's better for my student. Mm-hmm. So I'm anxious to see in the future where this virtual goes and how much parents stay with it. Because in my mind, virtual is more difficult on the family than it is bricks and mortar. It's easy to dump them off at school for 8 hours a day. But when you have to be home with them and get a lunch and all those different things and get them going, it's more work on the parent. So it has become more troublesome on the family. So I'm anxious to see where this goes post-COVID as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, and thank you for that question. I think you've sort of made my point, which is I wouldn't assume that some of those people may choose to go back to a traditional school next year, but some of them are going to go like you've discovered, boy, this is great for me, and they're going to continue to do that, and that's part of the landscape that we have to deal with moving forward. Not to speak for the governor, I think his point was having choice and giving, you know, unfortunately 46 states in the country have chosen to not follow the science and deprive parents of the option to send their kids to five-day school. But to be clear, in Florida, before COVID, you did not have to send your kid to five-day in-person school. All of these virtual options existed beforehand. They will exist afterward. But as it relates to testing in person, we talked and we heard from a superintendent last week who's concerned that sometimes, particularly in the COVID world, homeschool equals no school. Certainly doesn't mean it in many cases, if not most cases. We do have an obligation to make sure children are being educated, and I think that's where that testing does that. And as the father of a seventh grader, I think, you know, having them do those tests where they can be supervised in person and make sure there's no funny business going on, I think is a good idea. And it's not, I don't think, that difficult for, you know, a couple of times a year, a school to put in place, you know, appropriate social distancing so people can take a test for a couple of hours. Yes, Representative Wilhite. Ranking Member Wilhite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to follow up to that, and I think what leads me to then to be concerned is where parents have chosen and students are excelling on virtual school, to then have to go put them in a bricks and mortar school in a situation where they are unknown, even if it's in social distancing and a clean situation, still could give them somewhat anxiety or not being in their normal setting, that maybe I'm concerned to see that the testing will not keep in par with what their grades are on a normal basis, because they are now put in or thrust into a situation where they maybe don't feel as comfortable. And so I'm anxious to see if there is any correlation between those testing scores versus their regular daily grades. Once this does happen, if they do have to go back to bricks and mortars to actually take those physical tests in person. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. And to be clear, it's not going back to bricks and mortar to go back to school. It's to go and take the test to make sure you've learned your math or learned your English or your civics. We all agree in accountability. Many of us have different ways we want to get to it, but I think we all want to make sure that students are actually learning. Are there any other questions relating to
Chairman
to virtual education?
I'm sorry, I should have sat further.
It's hard to sit up here in the front and the middle. So, Representative McClain, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of different topic questions.
Go for it.
Okay, thank you. On the first slide, on the virtual instruction slide, there's you know, seven ways that virtual can be implemented. I know Denise probably will have these. Could we find out how many districts offer or employ more than one of the types of virtual education? Could we find out how many districts have an agreement with another district? Could we find out how many districts have private operators that they're that they have agreements with,
yes,
maybe just along all just I just want to know how many districts are doing what and maybe what the mix is of all the things that they're doing possibly.
Yes, we can get that. And just so everyone knows, contract with, there are eight virtual instruction providers that are available, and there are five virtual charter schools, and there are seven virtual course providers. So that's 20 entities between the three non-FLVS, non-do-it-yourself options.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Go
ahead.
Thank you. Also, I was gonna assume, but I shouldn't do that, right? So normally, when a private provider enters into a contract with a district, that contract is between the district and the private provider?
Yes.
Thank you. Also, how up on slide six, where you showed us the increase in enrollment and all that, when were those numbers developed?
I think this is October or June or last? This is probably the last count. The last count. So it's probably the October count because we don't have the February. I don't think we have the February numbers yet. So, yeah, so this is from October.
Okay, thank you.
So some of those kids may have gone back to traditional school, particularly at the semester break. But, again, we don't know. Some of them are going to say, boy, this is for me. I want to do this forever.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. I think...
Go ahead. You're recognized.
Part of the... For me... it seems that there's a lot of redundancy in the virtual school system in general. I'm not picking on anybody. I'm not picking on a school district or anything else or any of the providers. It just seems there's a lot of redundancy when we have 67 counties that can provide their own virtual. We've got, you know, 20 providers. We've got this. We've got that. And it seems like it's a pretty spread out system. And for me, normally when you have redundancy, you probably have some financial implications from that. Then I also think that we certainly need to make sure that there's competition between providers and those types of things. So thank you for allowing me to ask those questions and make the comment.
And that's a fair point. and I don't want to name, you know, we named the three school districts that have the kind of, you know, most out of network, if you will, out of county students. But I will tell you that we believe part of it is happening basically like Facebook ads. You know, schools are, and there have actually been lawsuits where a school district or where people thought, actually Florida Virtual School sued because they said the name is just like our name. And so students, parents might have thought they were signing their child up for Florida Virtual School, and they were signing their child up for not Florida Virtual School, but it had a name very similar to Florida Virtual School. I will also tell you that in one of these instances, the amount of money the school district is paying the virtual provider is materially less than the amount of money that they're getting from the state to educate that student. And so, I don't know, if you had 1,000 students from out of district, and you're basically, what's going on, it's effectively, it's student laundering. And you're educating those students through your provider, and you're paying that provider $1,000 less than you're getting from the state. 1,000 students times $1,000 is $1 million of basically money. And in some of these districts, remember one of these districts that had 5,000 students, 1,000 times 1,000 times 5,000 is 5 million. Hendry County, for example, is a very, very small school district. That's a huge amount of money as a percentage of their school budget. So there are some, I think there are, the complexity creates the opportunity for nefariousness. And I'm not definitively saying that's what's going on here, but I am saying you see some issues, as you point out, Representative McLean, you know, with these kinds of numbers, and it raises the question as to why. If Florida Cyber Charter Academy is a great education option, and I don't know whether it is or not, but if it is a great education option, why would we not just open it up to all 67 counties and just make it simple? If the Digital Academy of Florida is a superior option to Florida Virtual School, why would we not just open that up and let people do it? Why would we make them be laundered through Hendry County to take advantage of that option? Yes, Representative Andrada, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Hendry County has been discussed a good amount over the course of the committee weeks. But in looking at how it's funded based on completion and looking at how you described it with the, you know, historical data to estimate the total number of FTE that will complete, when you see that massive increase, did we learn anything about whether or not our way that we estimate probable completion is accurate enough to not put us at significant risk of some type of, you know, budget shortfall or additional commitment? So if our historical data, you know, would say that 10% of students or 20% of students would normally not complete, and then suddenly Hendry County has this massive increase and 95% of students complete, does that put the state funding mechanism at risk?
Well, we don't have the data because the 2020-2021 school year is not over. But that is something we'll have to look at. But as Ranking Member Wilhite attested, and as I will attest in my own situation with my son, it is harder to get a completion when they're virtual than when you're sending them to school, because fundamentally it's the parents at home that are having to do the accountability, as opposed to when you send the kid to school. So it is hard to do. I think if I wasn't on my son every day to work on his stuff, and he's a pretty smart kid, I don't know that he'd complete. So I think that is one of the challenges, and we don't know, because again, this is it's an explosion due to COVID. And so we will learn and we will see, and it may turn out their completion rate's spectacular. It may turn out that it's terrible. We don't have a lot of this data at this point, but it is an issue to be looked at. And what I take away from this is, again, what I took away from this is if the Digital Academy of Florida is a great, I believe in school choice. So if the Digital Academy of Florida is a great choice and isn't just reinventing the wheel that Florida Virtual School does, if it's a great alternative choice, then why would we make you, force you to go through Hendry County? The great thing about virtual is it doesn't matter where you are. You can be on a boat in the middle of the ocean. And so I think that's one of the things that we're looking at is why have we delegated this sort of scalable idea to 67 districts where it becomes a big mush, as Representative McClain talked about. Representative McClain, did you get a chance to ask all your questions? Okay. Any other members, any other questions? All right. Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
I just wanted to know, as long as we're looking into this for the future, can we also look into, in addition to completion, I think it's really important since they are participating in standardized testing and EOCs, is percentage of pass rates, reading levels, because like you said, if you're not monitoring it carefully and their funding is based on completion, you want to make sure that the completion is of a quality, high quality education, and that to compare the completion rate with how many kids are reading on level and things like that, and how many are passing the EOC.
Sure, we want to make sure this is working. But I think one of the things I didn't know before I got this job was, I thought if you went virtual, you sort of went to Florida virtual school. I didn't realize there were 20 companies out there all sort of doing the same exact thing that Florida virtual school is actually doing at the state level. By the way, one other FYI to bring back as we wrap up to our last presentation. If you'll remember, Florida virtual school exploded. The hold harmless, Florida virtual did not get the extra money for all those students showing up. They were, I think, $83 million deprived of funding because of the way, remember, if you saw if your school district went up, you didn't get extra money. So they were the largest school that was deprived of funding because for this school year, we chose not to have the funds follow the student. We chose to fund based on what we thought would happen. So Florida Virtual has had to teach a whole lot more students without a whole lot more funding. Just something everybody should know. All right, if there are no other questions, let me make sure I do what I'm supposed to do. All right, well, members, this concludes our business for this week. We are scheduled for two committee meetings next week, Monday the 8th from 10 to noon, and Wednesday the 10th from 1:30 to 2:30. I encourage you all to be on time on Monday because I will be very tired driving back from my son's bar mitzvah this weekend. So if I have to be here by 10 o'clock on Monday, so do the rest of you. So I hope that everyone has a great rest of their week. And again, congratulations on a first day of session. With that, members, this concludes our committee agenda. If there is no further business, Representative Williams moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.